up against the West, something that Iran is preaching?
Well, look, that indeed is an uniting factor. But I think the situation is somewhat different than even sort of 10 years ago. But if you look at it in the last 50 odd years, that African leaders who did stand up to the West, like Lumumba, or like, Ghanan, leader of Ghana, either there was a coup at that time or they were killed. But now capacity has built, and then nations have actually decided individually that their destiny has been sort of hijacked, if you like, by depending on the West. So this convergence that is taking place of the exploited nations, of the nations that were opposed, that the nations that lost their dignity. And as I said in my opening comment, is that Iran has actually provided the infrastructure and the platform for nations to stand up and be counted as dignified sovereign nations. And I think that's the key factor.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you to you both. Elias Amara, journalist and geopolitical analyst from Oakland, California. A pleasure. And Shabir Rizvi, thank you, political analyst from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahweh and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israelis have taken to the streets for the 28th week in a row to voice their opposition to judicial overhaul plans proposed by PM Netanyahu. Azerbaijan and Armenia hold talks mediated by the European Union in a fresh attempt to end hostilities between the two neighbors. And the number of people killed in floods and landslides in South Korea rises to 33 as rescue operation is underway to find those trapped in a flooded tunnel. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. It's good to have you with us. More than 100,000 Israelis have flocked to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest for the 28th consecutive week against the controversial reforms advanced by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right coalition. In Tel Aviv, protesters unrolled a massive banner reading SOS while blocking major highways and disrupting operations. Protesters brandished lit torches outside of Netanyahu's home and demonstrated in the coastal cities of Herzliya and Netanya. The mass protests are gaining momentum as the Israeli parliament gave initial approval to a key portion of the overhaul earlier this week. The legislation package would roll back some of the Supreme Court's powers and give the ruling coalition decisive sway in picking judges. The bill still needs to be approved in two more votes expected by the end of the month before it becomes law. Israel's labor union and medical association, military reservists, fighter pilots, and business leaders, as well as the regime's allies, namely the U.S., have all called for the halt of the plan. Protest leaders promise further days of disruption lie ahead. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says the controversial reforms introduced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu could lead to strikes like the one which happened back in March.
The strike that was that happened last March is probably going to be called again if things continue. This will decimate the Israeli economy. Now, Israel is self-destructing as we watch it, and that's not a bad thing, certainly. But one thing that's important is that the Israelis, people are demonstrating against injustices that are going to be perpetrated upon them. They don't care about the injustices that are being and have been perpetrated on the Palestinians for decades. It's the idea that they're going to be negatively impacted, and they're Israelis, they're Zionists, and they won't put up with this. But Netanyahu is holding fast against huge numbers of his people, against all of Israel's allies, but he's still maintaining this desire for this judicial overhaul. They want to be able to violate current laws and international law with complete impunity. They want to be able to basically commit genocide against the Palestinian people, and there has been minimal restrictions of that over the years, but they want to remove those minimal restrictions and just have free rein to do whatever they want to for Zionist Israelis and everyone else be damned. And this is what basically is going to be the outcome of this overhaul.
The Israeli army has fired tear gas towards a Lebanese member of parliament who was touring an area near the Israeli-occupied Sheva Farms. The Lebanese lawmaker Qasem Hashem was accompanied by a group of journalists. Several people, including Hashem, have reportedly been injured. Israeli forces demanded that journalists leave the area despite the fact that they were in Lebanon's territory. The area near Lebanon's southern border has recently witnessed tensions after Israeli occupation forces erected a barbed wire fence and constructed a concrete wall around the entire occupied village of Al-Hajar. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, says Israel is capturing more areas in southern Lebanon amid the inaction of the international organizations.
Now, what we are looking at is something that is considered by Hezbollah, and they have been monitoring it, and it has been also explained elaborately by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah very recently. He spoke about how Hezbollah have been monitoring the situation, and the Israelis have been basically taking in, bit by bit, more Lebanese land, especially in the area of the village of Ghajar. Now, the Ghajar village's situation is a bit different from what we have in the Sheba Farms. At the Sheba Farms, we have some complications there, since in the United Nations, it is not clear whether it's Syrian or Lebanese. The Lebanese say it is a Lebanese territory. Even Syrian officials have told Lebanon, but we are yet to demarcate that area and to make it official. But the Ghajar village is officially Lebanese. We have Lebanese documents. We have people who own that property, and they clearly say it is Lebanese. It has been since the demarcation between Lebanon and Palestine. Now, that is where the problem lies, since the Israelis are very openly taking more land from that village. So what Hezbollah decided to do, since they have called on the Lebanese government on and on for the past year, to take things into their own hands, to follow things up diplomatically. And when things were not solved as such, or the international players, the United States, they did not really heed to the call of the Lebanese government.
The EU Council President says peace and normalization between Azerbaijan and Armenia can be achieved by stopping violence and harsh rhetoric.
It's a matter of priority. Violence and harsh rhetoric should stop in order to provide a proper environment for peace and normalization talks. I also reiterated my intention to invite the Armenian and Azerbaijani leaders for another meeting in Brussels after the summer, as well as for another pentalateral meeting with the participation also of the leaders of France and Germany in Grenada in the margins of the next European Community Summit.
Mitchell said the current state of affairs is clearly not sustainable and is in no one's interest. He made the remarks after trilateral talks with Azerbaijani and Armenian presidents. In the meeting, they discussed possible steps to help bring the situation back to normal in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. This comes as Russia offered to host the two countries' foreign ministers and suggested a future peace treaty could be signed in Moscow. The Nagorno-Karabakh region has been at the center of a decades-long dispute between the two countries, which have fought two wars over the mountainous territory. The region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but has a primarily Armenian population.
Strikes by airport and airline staff have grounded hundreds of flights in Italy and also in Belgium, causing large-scale travel disruptions across the two European nations. In Italy, some 1,000 flights, including domestic and international ones, have been canceled as a result of the walkout. The strike action has so far left 250,000 travelers stranded throughout the country. Italian airline staff are calling for higher pay and better working conditions. A similar strike is also underway in Belgium, where more than 100 flights are to be impacted by the walkout. Belgian trade unions have warned that as many as 80% of the pilots could walk out during the action. Italy's far-right government keeps broadcasting that the country's GDP is on the rise despite the fact that wealth distribution across the Italian peninsula has never been so uneven.
GDP is a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation. Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is there for all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
In South Korea, at least seven bodies have been discovered from a flooded tunnel as days of heavy rain have caused deadly floods and landslides in the country. At least 15 vehicles have been trapped in muddy waters in an underpass in the central city of Cheongju. Rescue operation is underway to find people still remained trapped in the tunnel. The latest fatalities have brought the total death toll to at least 33. Most of the other deaths have happened in the North Gyeongsang region, where landslides have destroyed whole houses. South Korea has been hit by heavy rainfall since July 9, which has intensified in recent days. It has caused flooding, landslides, and power cuts across much of the country. Wildfires in Canada have burned more than 10 million hectares this year, a record-breaking figure, which will continue to rise in the coming weeks. That's according to government data. The country has seen a total of more than 4,000 fires since January. 900 of those are still active. The scale of the fires and their multitude have forced authorities not to intervene and let the majority burn. Many of the fires are far from inhabited areas. However, more than 150,000 people have been displaced, and a firefighter died on Thursday. In the U.S., the smoke blown in from the wildfires have caused hazy skies and dangerous air quality. Experts have warned that cities like Chicago and New York may soon have the worst air quality in the world. Earlier, we were joined by our Chicago correspondent, Ramin Mazari, who gave us more details about the expected wave of hazy skies in the U.S.
This is different from the last round of wildfires. Those wildfires were from Quebec, the Canadian province of Quebec, which is in the east. And these wildfires are coming from the western province of British Columbia. So it's not expected that these wildfires are going to hit the northeast like they did a few weeks ago. It's going to hit the Midwest, meaning the Dakotas and Nebraska, Missouri, possibly Arkansas, as far south as Arkansas. So what's the reason behind these fires is you have 400 fires that have been sparked by violent thunderstorms with a lot of lightning strikes, and some people are saying that this is a result of climate change, more violent weather, and that certainly seems very, very likely. The thing to keep in mind with these wildfires, when we're talking about two of the countries here in North America, is that this happens on the West Coast with regularity. You know, California is consumed by wildfires seemingly all the time. And it was really, the East Coast dominated media here in the United States, they really only paid attention when the smoke hit New York City and got as far south as Washington, D.C. A few weeks ago. But
the Southeast Asian bloc ASEAN has held a security meeting in which top diplomats from the U.S., China, and Russia were in attendance. Some of the issues discussed were the disputed South China Sea, the Ukraine war, and North Korea's missiles. But the issue of most concern, the stability of the region.
The 27-member ASEAN Regional Forum meeting in Indonesia. In attendance, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, China's top diplomat Wang Yi, and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Officials from Japan, South Korea, the U.K., and Australia were also present. Blinken and Lavrov's presence at the meeting was filled with tensions, but no bilateral talks would take place. Issues like Myanmar were still of major importance to the bloc.
Kita juga menerima dukungan yang kuat dari pertemuan bilateral dan trilateral terhadap peluasan fokus ARF dari CBM juga menjadi preventif diplomasi.
The Indonesian foreign minister did not waste any time addressing what was on her mind. She likened geopolitical tensions in the Indo-Pacific as a Cold War in hot places, in reference to U.S. provocations against China. The ASEAN chair and Indonesian President Widodo said the gathering aimed to seek solutions rather than exacerbate regional and global problems.
ASEAN berkomitmen memperkuat persatuan dan soliditas serta sentralitas ASEAN dalam menjaga perdamaian dan stabilitas di kawasan.
Yet the U.S. Secretary of State failed to see the concern of ASEAN when it came to the U.S. provocations against China.
I think we share the same vision for the region that we share, a free, open, secure, prosperous, connected, resilient region. And the work that we're doing together is trying to make that vision real.
The former Chinese ambassador to the U.S. believes that the United States only pays lip service to the ASEAN centrality.
ASEAN centrality is one of the most important principles in regional cooperation in Asia Pacific. And ASEAN countries attach great importance to that. We in China also attach great importance to that. Frankly, I think the United States very often just pay lip service to this principle. They also talk about, well, they like this idea.
Indeed.
But watch what they are doing. There's no ASEAN in Quad. There is no ASEAN in AUKUS. So where is the central role of ASEAN?
The ASEAN centrality emphasizes the association's dominant regional role to overcome common challenges and to engage with external powers. The U.S. has been criticized for building mechanisms and initiatives in the Asia-Pacific region, bypassing the ASEAN, even though it says it respects the ASEAN centrality.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
in the limelight.
Scientists say even moderate heat strains the human heart. They say people can experience cardiovascular strain, a progressive increase in heart rate, before their internal temperatures are affected. In this regard, the scientific magazine Nature has provided an exclusive article. Stay tuned for more. A recent study has found air temperatures as low as 34 degrees Celsius can lead to a steady increase in heart rate under humid conditions. This rise, also known as cardiovascular strain, occurs even before a person's internal temperature starts to rise. The findings are among a slew of recent results about the heart's struggles when exposed to heat. Scientists say this work is becoming even more relevant as extreme heat events becomes more frequent. Just recently, the average temperature worldwide hit a record high 2 days in a row. Rachel Cottle, a researcher in exercise physiology at the Pennsylvania State University In-State College and co-author of the paper, which was published recently in the Journal of Applied Physiology, said, "More people are going to be exposed to heat waves and potentially be at risk. But work to identify the combination of temperature and humidity that endangers the heart could inform strategies to protect human health," she says. To pinpoint the threshold for heart risk, Cottle and her colleagues had young, healthy participants engaged in light physical activity inside an environmental chamber, whose temperature or humidity rose every 5 minutes. The researchers monitored each individual's core temperature, the temperature of their internal organs, using sensors inside capsules that the participants had swallowed. The team also measured participants' heart rates. As the chamber got hotter, participants' heart rates increased and then plateaued. But as the chamber continued to heat up, the volunteers' heart rates started to rise again and were still rising when the experiment ended. Indicating cardiovascular strain in humid conditions, participants who were walking slowly experienced cardiovascular strain when the temperature was around 34 degrees Celsius. When the air was dry, that threshold was around 41 degrees Celsius. Cardiovascular strain always began about 20 minutes before the participants' core temperatures started to rise. Because heart rate is so easy to measure, it could be a useful warning sign. Cottle says, if all of a sudden you notice your heart rate going up quickly and progressively, then that might mean that your core temperature will start to rise. That's when you need to take precautionary measures. But Craig Crandall, director of the Thermal and Vascular Physiology Lab at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, is cautious. The team's finding that heart rate goes up before core temperature might stem from delays between a rise in core temperature and its measurement in the gut, he says. Other research has shown that heat can affect the heart even when people are not moving. A study by Louis Hasley at the University of Rompton in London and his colleagues found that at 50% humidity, The heart rate of participants at rest was, on average, 64% higher at 50 degrees Celsius than 28 degrees Celsius. Halsey says, so if you are resting and you're out in the sun, on the beach or whatever, your heart rate will still increase. When the temperature rises, the human body typically activates two main mechanisms to regulate core temperatures: sweating and increasing the blood flow from the core to the skin. While this is happening, you also have an increased metabolic demand that requires an increased heart rate, says Barak Almond, a specialist in climate change and health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Massachusetts, adding, so we are asking the heart to work harder while taking blood away from it. For healthy young adults, that extra effort might be harmless, but for older people or those with existing heart conditions, exposure to extreme heat could be lethal. According to a 2022 meta-analysis, a temperature increase of just 1 degree Celsius is associated with a 2.1% increase in the risk of death related to cardiovascular disease.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's program, we'll be discussing the recent IMF bailout package secured by Pakistan and Iran-Saudi relations, which can positively impact Pakistan. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Pakistan's vicious IMF cycle, and we shall also take a look at Pakistan's growth in the backdrop of Iran-Saudi relations.
Pakistan went to the IMF in 1958, just 11 years after its creation. Now more than 60 years, the current $3 billion deal is the country's 23rd IMF package. This dependence on foreign loans and aids have entangled the country in a never-ending economic crisis. Financial experts believe that the country will again be in need of another bailout package in the immediate future, thus limiting Pakistan's chances of coming out of the debt cycle.
A never-ending trade deficit, heavy borrowing to finance its spending, and poor debt management. Pakistan has been reduced to an economy that consumes more than it produces, relying on debt both from foreign and national sources. After the IMF deal, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are also expected to provide combined $3 billion in financing to Islamabad. Saudi Arabia has made its aid conditional to Pakistan's revamping of economic policies similar to the IMF rules. According to economic analysts, the manipulative external financial help reduces entrepreneurship opportunities, makes the country dependent on imports, discouraging the economic growth, thus preventing Pakistan to become self-reliant. Dealing with grueling repayments of its foreign debts, with record high inflation, the country is going to elections later this year. Some political commentators believe that procurement of the IMF financial package will be used by some political parties to secure their position in the upcoming election.
The initial draft of the 2023-24 budget failed to meet the IMF expectations. It was revised hurriedly to introduce new taxes and expenditure cuts to fulfill the conditions put forward by the global lender for loan bailouts. Economic analysts say the neoliberal policies that Islamabad has been trying to follow over the years to be granted loans by the IMF have not helped improve the lives of people, but instead have been fulfilling the interests of a section of elites.
The Central Bank of Pakistan has been asked by the World Monetary Body to remain proactive to control inflation. On the demand of IMF, the bank had to hike the key rate by 100 basis points after the financial organization objected to its unchanged rate. The power sector of Pakistan, which has been specifically mentioned by the IMF to rebase the tariffs timely, has raised prices for the consumers despite record high inflation in the present year. The IMF has also asked the country to withdraw import restrictions put in place for controlling external payments, as the cash-stripped country's reserves stand at $3.5 billion, barely enough to cover a month's imports. The other condition that the world lender has put forward is full commitment to a market-determined exchange rate without taking into consideration the fall of rupee to record lows in the recent weeks. Foreign affairs analysts have said the loan that IMF gives to countries like Pakistan is designed to trap a country in endless debt at the behest of the United States.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by economic analyst Mr. Javed Hassan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Hassan.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You're more than welcome. Now, Mr. Hassan, Pakistan has recently secured a $3 billion financial package from the IMF. Will it really offer relief to Pakistan's economic crisis, keeping in view the neoliberal economic policies Islamabad will have to adopt?
It will offer relief in the sense that Pakistan will avert default in the short run, given that if we hadn't received this $3 billion bailout, Pakistan would have imminently faced potential default, which would have had severe impact on the populace as a whole. So in that, it has provided some relief to the people. Yes, I think so. But in that, it will improve the lifestyle and general welfare of the people. I don't think so. There's still a lot that has to be done. The economy still is in a very dire situation. There is still high inflation, near 30% inflation. There's still scarcity of essential goods. So I don't think it provides a lot of relief, but it does provide for things not getting worse.
Now, Mr. Hassan, financial experts have warned that the country will need another bailout package immediately. Now, you've hinted this before, but I want you to explain a bit more in detail. How is this dependence on loans and packages destroying Pakistan's economy?
The thing is that Pakistan has to, over the next 3 years, repay loans, principal repayments plus interest in the tune of something like $75 billion. If you include current account deficits of about $6 to $7 billion every year, then you're looking at a repayment external outflow of something like $91 billion. So this makes Pakistan highly dependent on external borrowing. This is not something which has happened just in the last few years. It has been a culmination of over 30 years or 35 years of bad policies. Pakistan does not export enough. Pakistan does not produce enough to cover its own requirements. So it has to import much more than it can export. As a result, it is highly dependent on foreign inflows. It gets some inflows through remittances and also some from exports, but that is not sufficient to cover the imports that it has. As a result, it has continuously borrowed, and the borrowing is now having to be repaid. So there is no avoidance of this. At some point, I think Pakistan will need to restructure its debt and such that it gets some fiscal space to spend on its people and grow. Right now, there is no such space.
Like you mentioned, it's been happening for decades now. So the current IMF deal in Pakistan is Pakistan's 24th package since the formation in 1947. So do you see Islamabad coming out of this debt cycle?
Not in the near term, no. Unfortunately not. If anything, the debt cycle is getting worse. The government borrowing is even higher than it has been in the past. The speed at which government borrowing and government debt is increasing is accelerating rather than decelerating. There is nothing to suggest that Pakistan is getting out of its difficulties. What we have from the IMF loan is a short-term reprieve. It is not a cancellation of the debt sentence. So we are just basically postponing difficulties that are going to come in not too distant future.
That's right. So you've mentioned bad policies in your second question. Now, the long political turmoil in the country is regarded as an important reason for the failing economy. In what way are the opportunistic political policies contributing to the deepening financial crisis?
Well, the lack of comprehensive mandate or the ability of the political forces to do what is necessary in the economy, it really compounds the difficulties. To start with, Pakistan has a very low tax to GDP ratio. It's below 10% and continues to remain below 10%. Numerous think tanks, including IMF, have repeatedly suggested that Pakistan needs to broaden its tax base so that if it borrows its tax base, it can generate more revenues. Once it does that, it probably needs to borrow less. But given the political expedience that politicians have, they don't want to tax the retail sector, they don't want to tax the agricultural sector, they don't want to tax the property sector. Given all this, a large share of the economy is not taxed, and because the same people are taxed more and more, given that they are taxed more and more, they become more inefficient, and the other sectors continue to grow. So effectively, what we have is insufficient tax base, more and more borrowing from both domestic and external sources. So we are actually increasing the difficulties rather than reducing it. And there is no sign of a major change in policy direction as of now.
Thank you, sir. There you have it, Mr. Javed Hassan from Islamabad. He's an economic analyst. Thank you for being on the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
More than welcome. And now let's see how people have reacted to the recent IMF bailout package secured by Pakistan.
Euphoric, a technology learner interested in music, photography and spirituality, tweeted, "Nothing new for Pakistan. It is like having a credit card from Chinese, Saudi, Turkey, UAE, World Bank, IMF and using the money to pay here and there and put a bandage on an incurable disease." Erica Brown, a China observer and UN consultant from the US, tweeted, "Why will Pakistan remain a slave country forever? Because autonomous nations do not rely on loans, aid and remittances from other countries. Pakistan exists because since independence it is living on foreign aid." Steve Hank, professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, tweeted, "Debt-ridden countries like Pakistan are kidding themselves if they think passing the begging bowl to the IMF and taking on more IMF debt will solve their problems." Zaid Ahmed, a netizen from Pakistan, tweeted, It's indeed temporary positive development for Pakistan. But again, after some time, we will again run to IMF and make life of people harsher and harsher.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
The recent reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia, brokered by China, has opened up a new chapter of possibilities, presenting both economic opportunities and strategic benefits for Pakistan. Strategic affairs experts believe that the restoration of diplomatic ties and the resumption of bilateral cooperation between these two significant players in the Middle East can pave the way for enhanced trade, energy connections, and stability in the region. With Pakistan's geographic proximity to both Iran and Saudi Arabia, this reconciliation presents significant opportunities for the South Asian countries' economic and regional influence.
Iran has long been an important trading partner for Pakistan, while Saudi Arabia remains a major economic ally, with a large Pakistani diaspora contributing to its workforce and remittance inflows. Analysts say that the restoration of diplomatic ties will foster a conducive environment for trade and investment, benefiting Pakistan's economy and providing a much-needed boost to the South Asian Muslim country. Pakistan's close ties with China in the context of China's Belt and Road Initiative, coupled with the restoration of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, presents a unique opportunity to align the interests of all parties involved. This alignment, according to financial experts, is believed to contribute to the success of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and the broader BRI, fostering economic growth and regional integration. Furthermore, recent steps taken by Pakistan and Iran to open up the trade market at the common border have paved the way for discussions on currency swap agreement and transit mechanisms between Tehran and Islamabad.
Tensions in the Middle East have long been a cause of concern, but the Iran-Saudi détente marks a turning point in the complex geopolitics of the Middle East. Regional experts maintain that Pakistan, with its balanced approach and historical efforts to mediate between Iran and Saudi Arabia, stands poised to capitalize on the positive momentum. By maintaining diplomatic ties with both the nations, Pakistan can act as a bridge, fostering dialogue and cooperation, ultimately contributing to a more stable and prosperous region.
Proximity between Tehran and Riyadh has a significant impact on Pakistan's internal security and political stability. Historically, Saudi Arabia has closely monitored Pakistan's relations with Iran, exerting pressure on Islamabad to toe its line. However, this recent agreement eliminates a significant obstacle, allowing Pakistan to expand trade and strategic cooperation with both Iran and Saudi Arabia. The Iran-Saudi reconciliation agreement, despite having economic benefits, serves as an opportunity for Pakistan to address sectarian tensions within its borders. Foreign affairs analysts believe by reducing tensions and promoting religious tolerance, this reconciliation can help alleviate the sufferings of Pakistan's significant Shia population, helping to create an atmosphere of harmony and coexistence.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst and author Mr. Mir Muhammad Ali Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ali Khan.
Thank you so much, brother.
You're welcome, sir. Now, let's begin with the questions. The normalization of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia opens up new opportunities for trade and economic cooperation. So my question is, how can Pakistan use this development to maximize its economic potential?
First of all, my congratulations as a Pakistani that relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have normalized. I love this. Until Pakistan comes out of the American bloc, I don't think we can benefit anything from this. I want Pakistan to benefit from this, and there's so much Pakistan can gain, but Pakistan politicians are absolutely influenced by America. If Iran and Saudi Arabia can have normalization of ties, then Pakistan can stand up for its own rights, and Iran being our neighbor, Saudi Arabia being a country which Pakistan has long-standing brotherly relationship with, it is a wonderful omen for Pakistan if it comes out of the American bloc. Until then, I don't think much can be done.
Now, sir, away from the economic aspect of it, improved relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have the potential to reduce sectarian tensions in Pakistan. How can Islamabad leverage this opportunity to promote religious tolerance and coexistence within its borders?
If Pakistan does not control its internal bigotry of organizations, now it is the perfect time to say that none of the countries are supporting, neither of the countries are supporting anything here. Pakistan needs to crack down. We have seen tens of thousands of sectarian killings in Pakistan from both sides. This is the best opportunity to close down those outlets that spread sectarian violence, sectarian bigotry. Those must need to be closed down. And those other countries that always demand from Pakistan that sectarian violence be finished, I think they do have a logical demand from Pakistan. And this is the best opportunity for Pakistan, because now we cannot have any excuse that Iran is supporting anything or Saudi is supporting anything. This excuse has worked some logically and some illogically, but now there is no excuse left.
That's right, Mr. Ali Khan. Now, we know that the renewal of Iran-Saudi relations could also help diffuse regional rivalries. How can Pakistan seize this opportunity to reduce the influence of extremist groups and enhance the security and also stability?
Economic betterment is absolutely related to security of any country. When we control this extremism within our own country, We can, along with Iran, we can become a regional group of countries more powerful than anything which has been witnessed in the past 25, 30, 40, 50 years. Iran is our neighbor. Iran is one of the largest oil producers, gas producers. Why are we shying away from having an economic tie with Iran? With collaboration of Iran, we can get cheaper oil and transfer of technology. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, Malaysia, there's so many countries that can have a bloc, an economic bloc. Why can't we have an economic bloc that benefits Pakistan and the region? Afghanistan is opened up. Iran is working with Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia is working with Afghanistan. Why can't we put up an economic bloc for this region that benefits everything and have cordial relationship with America? Let not America dictate to us what Pakistan should do and Pakistan should not do. The biggest problem is that we have lost out on economic betterment with Iran when it comes to vis-a-vis Pakistan and Iran because of the fact that we are always being dictated by America.
So, sir, one of the reasons could be the sanctions. So what could these two countries do?
You see, the sanction is a sword that America hangs on every country. Iran has had sanctions. Isn't Iran growing? I've been to Iran so many times. I see that country growing. Why didn't America, if Saudi Arabia and Pakistan can have great ties, Iran and Saudi Arabia can have great ties, we can have great ties with both the countries without having any sanctions. Why should... Sanctions are not that easy to put. Those days are gone. This globalized world, we can't have sanctions put on us like that without any reason. Doing business with Iran, so the whole world is doing business with Iran. Why can't Pakistan do business with Iran?
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, let's talk about CPEC as well, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It's an integral part of the larger Belt and Road Initiative. So how can improved relations between Iran, Saudi Arabia and China further enhance the prospects of CPEC and also promote regional economic integration?
CPEC, one of the biggest investments of CPEC has been in Pakistan, of the biggest investments of BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, part, which is the parent project of China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Having Iran and Saudi Arabia both join CPEC along with Afghanistan, the route, the land route alone can go all the way to Europe. Pakistan can benefit so much by having Iran into CPEC. Saudi Arabia has already shown its interest to develop a $20 billion refinery city in Gwadar. Iran can do the same for Pakistan, and we can together rise. We need economic betterment. No betterment can come without economic betterment, and no economic betterment can come without holding hands with your neighbors. We can't have, we can't be not doing business with our neighbor because somebody 8,000 miles away in America says that we can't. Those days are gone. This is not 1970s and 80s where there is a Soviet bloc and there is an American bloc. Now this is a globalized world. And in this globalized world, we need to hold hands, and we need, as a Pakistani, I'm saying this, we need to think about Pakistan and Pakistani people rather than still being scared of the Western world.
There you have it, political analyst and author, Mr. Mir Muhammad Ali Khan from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, sir. And now let's take a look at how the global media has covered the Iran-Saudi relations and its impact on Pakistan.
Michael Kugelman, director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center, tweeted, "The China-mediated Iran-Saudi Arabia reconciliation is a black swan event, a surprise, rare watershed moment for international relations that will have major ripple effects across the globe, including South Asia, especially Pakistan, where Iran-KSA rivalry has played out heavily." Isa Ali, a researcher, wrote, "Reconciliation between Saudi and Iran benefits Pakistan. It will help Pakistan maintain a more balanced relationship between the two nations. As things stand, Saudi Arabia has financially been very helpful to Pakistan, whereas Iran is a regional trading partner." Naveed Aman Khan, an editor, political analyst and columnist, wrote, "Reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Iran would be of great relief for Muslims across the world, especially Pakistan. Pakistan needs to have strong, balanced ties with the two countries. On the other hand, Chinese diplomacy is winning well-deserved appreciation." Waqas Aslam Rana, a political commentator, tweeted, "China's foray into Middle East and South Asia plus Saudi-Iranian detente is opening up new opportunities for Pakistan. In particular, the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline, vital for our energy security, but for long blocked by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, may now have a chance."
And that was our episode on IMF damaging the economic basis of Pakistan and the friendly relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia set to benefit the South Asian Muslim country. We'll meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
The National Health Service, the NHS, has warned that malnutrition is a common problem in Britain, with millions of people being affected, with children under the age of 5, older people over the age of 65, and those with long-term health conditions most at risk. The National Health Service says 1 in 10 elderly people in Britain are malnourished or at risk of malnutrition. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Experts are saying Victorian-era illnesses such as scurvy and rickets are rebounding because of the cost-of-living crisis. Both conditions, which are consequences of malnutrition, largely vanished in the 20th century due to better diets. Nearly 11,000 people in England, including hundreds of children, were hospitalised with malnutrition last year. Data from the National Health Service England shows admissions due to serious condition have risen fourfold over the last 15 years and doubled in a decade. Although the uptick has been observed over the past decade, medical professionals warned that Britons are going to end up with more of these diseases of the Victorian era because of the cost of living crisis. The British people facing the pinch have been forced to cut back on fruits and vegetables and eat cheaper junk food, which lacks vital vitamins and minerals. A Freedom of Information request from the Times Health Commission shows that 10,896 NHS patients in England were hospitalised with malnutrition in the year to April 2023. Malnutrition occurs when a diet does not include the right amount of nutrients, with unintentional weight loss, a low body weight, and feeling tired and weak being key signs. The statistics also revealed that 171 people were treated with scurvy and 482 people were treated with rickets, with 405 of these patients being children. Scurvy is caused by not consuming enough vitamin C, which is found in citrus fruits, broccoli, and potatoes. Typical symptoms include feeling tired, weak and irritable, severe joint or leg pain, and swollen and bleeding gums. Rickets is usually caused by a lack of vitamin D. With sunlight, oily fish and eggs being key sources of vitamin D, or calcium, which is in milk, cheese and green vegetables. Painful bones, skeletal deformities and dental problems being telltale signs of